to see what you learn about the universe with 20 centimeter radiation. And we've had a series of studies on things you can do, science you can learn, and I think I'm going to focus a bit on, touch a bit upon more fundamental physics questions you can learn about it. So 21 centimeter, I suppose the room is familiar to everyone. It's emitted by hyperfine spin transition of hydrogen. Its basic advantages is that the radiative mechanisms are well understood. It's mostly optically thin, almost everywhere, to almost all redshift, along almost all lines of sight. So it's, you know, if you want to survey the universe, it seems to be a simple and clean way of doing it with no obvious obvious fundamental catches. It's been around for a while. This is a radio image in the 21 centimeter line of galaxies in the Virgo cluster. This actually is a montage, but it illustrates that one can actually make three-dimensional images instantaneously because you do spectroscopic imaging in the radio. Now, this has led, this idea is not all that new. People for the last couple of years now, there's been certainly a growing collection of very futuristic thinking theorists thinking about all the interesting things you could do if you really mapped out the whole universe in 21 centimeter, what you could learn. So I think the picture, somehow the, oh, this isn't it, the screen is a bit wider than my display, is, you know, the universe to scale, how much we've explored and how much we can learn. So the standard procedure of learning about the universe is to learn everything from a power spectrum, and the power spectrum you can measure to the accuracy of 1/√ of number of modes, okay? And so number of modes you get by having a large volume and by going to a small scale. So you want to be able to measure, you know, have a small scale that's well understood as the linear and the large amount of volume to get there. And this is supposedly drawn to co-moving angular diameter distance. So this tells you basically how many modes there are in co-moving volume. And just to give us an idea of, you know, this, the main Sloan survey is this green little patch in the middle. The red is about the depth of the Sloan luminous red galaxy survey. And as you go further out, you know, this black line is the CMB recombination surface. And those are the places we've probed so far. And now there's thought about mapping out this whole region in between. So the fact that the volume of the universe we've mapped out so far is certainly a very small fraction. There's a lot more left to be mapped. If you think of, you know, what kind of numbers you might be thinking about, you know, 10 to the 18, 20, you know, there's some large number of modes in principle that are out there that could be measured. And if you take the square root of that, that's, you know, can measure some number to, you know, 10 significant digits in principle. And the question is, you know, what could you learn when you had that thing? You just dimensionally estimate, well, you could try to find primordial gravity waves, primordial non-Gaussianity, obviously BAO, all these good things, you know, just dimensionally, you would say the information in the universe is good enough to constrain R to something like 10⁻⁸. So, you know, there's no statistical limit, at least, to how far you could push these things. I'm just repeating what very futuristic thinking theorists have been speculating on. You know, if you ask FNL, you know, we say, wouldn't it be nice to get FNL? Well, you know, statistically, again, you can get FNL to much higher position than even slow roll inflation would predict. Of course, you've got to, this is all assuming you can deal with some very non-trivial challenges along the way. Let me focus on three of these potential things we learn. One is, we learn about dark energy by measuring the kinetic expansion history of the universe at low-ish redshift, up to 2, which is where we think there might be an effect of such things. At redshift slightly larger, Q here and others have looked at the possibility of using these sources as gravitational lens sources to constrain modified gravity, and it is actually on large angular scales at these redshifts where you actually would have a dynamical difference between dark energy and some dark matter, some modified gravity models that, you know, we've heard a lot about over the last few days. And another window we could try to explore, as I said, the pre-reionization redshift when the universe was neutral and linear, in which regime you might be able to measure primordial gravitational waves. So, you know, one thing that we've talked with, good. And lots about modified gravity models. So here's an example of how big the observational impact is of modified gravity models on gravitational lensing. So this is the lensing power spectrum, two-dimensional projected for a source distributed between redshift 1 and 2.5. This is a plot from Kiyo's recent paper. And just to give you an idea of the scale, so as you go to higher L, you get better, you get more statistical accuracy. The fraction size of the L bars goes as 1 over L, the L squared modes. And at low L, of course, first of all, the theories don't differ that much, and also the statistical L gets large. By the time you get to an L of, you know, a few hundred, when the different models, when the CDM starts differing from an FFR model, for example, an allowed FFR parameter model, you have to go to fairly high L, and of course there are other complications, the fact that the linearity of the power spectrum, nonlinear effects are at least as large as the difference between the physics. So this, you know, all of this requires quantitative careful modeling that we'll hear about, I think, in the next talk. But in principle, at least, it gives you access to distinguish them, assuming you can, you know, deal with nonlinearities and other issues. And this is the kind of sensitivity you could get from surveys that are currently under discussion, like China, I'll mention a bit more later. Now, recent current work in progress here by Keel has been on whether how useful this would be to measure primordial gravity wave. As he said, you know, just the raw, complete, wild order of magnitude, you can go to R that are quite much lower than any other probe you might have of it. And currently, we're looking into how detectable the effect is. So let's say you want to measure something like, well, you know, of course, we know certain, several ways of trying to measure that from, for example, the microwave background B-mode polarization. That's the way you can go after the scalar, the tensor amplitude. To measure a tensor spectral index, that's a much more non-trivial requirement, where it's, you know, you'd have to measure, to do that, you have to measure the amplitude of the gravity wave spectrum at two different scales, and NT, obviously, for it to be a generically testable theory, you'd like to measure the deviation, like you like to measure a consistency relation, for example, and that has NT going as R or something like that. So, you know, if you've got to measure NT to 1% to be interesting. Measuring NT to 1% means you've got to measure the amplitude of the gravity waves at two scales to 1% each or better, in order to even have a hope of doing that. That's a non-trivial requirement that's hard. It's not obvious to see how you get there. I mean, if you try to increase your lever arm, people talk about building the BBO and measuring from, you know, light years up to gigaparsecs. You can try to make the lever arm large, or you can try to make the accuracy large at a modest factor of two scale in frequency, in wavelengths. But all of that is non-trivial, and of course you have to go to, you know, sufficient, you have to, just to get anything to 1%, you need 10,000 modes to do anything to that accuracy. So it's all statistical and requires a very large number of modes. This is different counting here. I said, in order to measure an amplitude like 10 to minus 6 or however large you think the inflationary strain might be, you need, you know, that many squared test particles to have a chance, if you have order unit error on each, to measure the waves themselves. And of course, then you need another, you know, 10 to the 5 modes or something to be able to measure a tilt. So that's, you need that much signal to noise per mode, and then you need 10 to the 4 modes, each requiring that many source modes to get some. This is, you know, a non-trivial requirement, and you can ask, is this a complete pipe dream, or is it something which is almost tractable with in our lifetimes, let's say, and or how long would you have to live? Does medicine have to make you live for 10,000 years, or could you do it in the next 10? I think that's the kind of question that would be interesting to know. And then, you know, even if it's possible, are there obvious known showstoppers that might make this impossible anyways? So he's looked at this a bit, and if you think of how you measure gravity waves, well, first, generically, you might think this problem is generically hard for many reasons, not just is the effect small. You have to go to a large sub-horizon scale to have enough modes for anything to happen. And then subhorizon scales the modes all decay away, meaning now you're really talking about going after really small modes. And it's small to start with, now they're getting even smaller. And this seems to be a receding shoreline trying to go after such a thing. It sounds fairly, rather non-trivial. But Kyo has been going through, and you know, it turns out that the redshift thing, it seems to be an effect that you can overcome, that there actually is a linear memory of the gravity waves after the after say redshift away, and that just comes from the fact that that you're using small scale scalar perturbations to reconstruct a long wavelength vector mode. So these two, you know, have to differ by at least 3 orders of magnitude in length scale to even have enough modes to do this. And if they're that far separated, you can the scalar modes are generated after the tensor mode has left the horizon, so they're generated isotropically in the local frame. And then after the gravity enters the horizon and redshifts away, you get a frame change, and all of a sudden, all these test particles find themselves in the wrong in the wrong configuration, and you can just go and measure the local anisotropy of the power spectrum. So the power spectrum gets sheared anisotropically, and you can build, just like in gravitational lensing reconstruction, you can build quadratic estimators, you can try to optimize it, but basically what you do is you take the gradient of a density field, take an outer product of two such gradients, that gives you a spin 2 object, which is linearly proportional to the local metric, basically, metric perturbation. So that's a modulo weighting these by optimal modulo convolving these density fields by optimal windows to maximize signal to noise. The basic procedure is just taking the gradient, multiplying it, that gives you an estimator for the metric. Now, conveniently, normally one of the worries, for example, in CMB polarization, is that there are other things which deflect your apparent metric, like gravitational lensing. But you can see in this approach, since you actually observe a three-dimensional spin to two-index tensor, you can decompose that into scalar vector and tensor modes. And of course, you know that gravity are two transverse traceless tensors in this on this object, whereas lensing can only cause scalar changes in here. So when you project it out, at least in principle, these tensor modes are not in linear order contaminated by gravitational lensing. It turns out even at post-Born, you can get displacements. It's a vector-like displacement, so lensing can only give a vector, can only originate to vector field, so you could even contaminate the vector components of it, but as far as we can tell, there's no way of contaminating the tensor components through an intermediate lensing field. So at least if you pick the right frame, these things are clean and orthogonal, and you can, in principle, get away with reconstructing underlying gravity waves. Put some numbers in. He was still working at it, but the thing I got from him just this afternoon was that the kinds of R's you can get on, you know, sensitivity, so you have to go to some redshift, in this case, I think it was 15, and you pick, you know, some K-max you can measure to. This is taken out of some, you know, square kilometer array type configuration of a telescope that kind of scale that's being discussed, at least, that may be built in, you know, the next decade or two. You need some survey volume, you need to pick some number of how much sky is out there, and you can come up with a number that, you know, R's and hopefully N's come up with some, you know, all things you can calculate. And as you can see, those are interesting regimes that these get to, that are, you know, as good as any other procedures to go after R, for example. You know, already, you know, even with things that you don't have to dream to the infinite future of, meaning what you've only of 15, you have a chance of seeing perhaps interesting effects in the modestly distant universe. Well, you can think of it the following way. So lensing is just a reshuffling of coordinates, like somebody relabeled your map for you and didn't tell you how they relabeled it. Okay, that's all lensing can ever do to your map, open displaced points. Now, if I take a metric, it's like a gauge. Somebody did a gauge transformation on it and didn't tell you what the gauge was that he picked. Okay, that's what lensing does to you. Well, now if you calculate, for example, invariance, I can now calculate the Riemann scalar or any intrinsic curvature quantity. Well, if it was intrinsically uncurved, lensing cannot cause any of these tensorial quantities to become non-zero. Okay, so if you build any gauge invariant quantity, then it doesn't matter what you had, and these will never be excited. So in lensing, you can build.
That's the thing. That you may do a gauge transformation on a metric, but yes, then coarse grain, and then you cannot tell whether these two metrics are equivalent after. So two metrics may be equivalent before Gauss fundamentally equivalent, but after coarse grinding, you cannot tell whether they're equivalent or not.
Well, okay, so if you actually put in, I mean, this is just, you know, counting with the freedom of where this comes from. In practice, okay, what you do is you build these quadratic estimators, right? And just ask, you know, as you shift your window field, you change the apparent scale in which you filter these things at, which is what these things do to you. And that's what gives rise to the apparent change in anisotropic expectation values. Now, there again, what you generally do is you just, you know, project this thing back out of the scale, and then you can just calculate, you know, how much goes in. And it's highly suppressed, but just because this thing, you know, has different kinematics. It's like, you know, polarization E and B modes. B modes, you know, just don't tend to only get excited by non-scalar processes.
But if these deflections are coherent, I can see that. But if the deflections are very on very small scales, then I don't think that's...
But there's a separation of scales here, right? That K max for smallest K scalar
source
that you're looking at, the source thing, right? The tensor mode you're looking at is like, you know, gigaparsec, right?
You are trying to reconstruct very long wavelength gravity waves with very short wavelength density perturbations. So it's only you always worry about the lensing modes at the gigaparsec scale, which is, you know, the low L. You talk about low L effect here, right? And the low L lensing is intrinsically a small effect to start with. Mm-hmm. And part, you don't have to clean up a huge amount.
The first power is 3 hours.
Sorry?
In the last equation, should be 3 hours.
It's
K max to the minus 3 hours.
K max is minus
3. K max is minus 3 because it's
your power. It's equal to h squared. That's the square of h. No, I h for the square of r.
Square
root
of
r. The tensor vector power ratio. That's the ratio of power is the ratio of amplitudes.
I see.
Okay, let's look at, you know, what are places to look for this effect. And the 21 centimeter spin evolution has been calculated. It can be cleanly calculated in a homogeneous universe, okay, which, let's see, so some futuristic thinking theorists have been talking about. So what happens is the temperature of the CMB is this dashed line, it just expands as 1 plus redshift. The kinetic temperature decouples from the CMB at a redshift of, you know, 100, just over 100. And start adiabatically cooling faster than the microwave background. So you're in the generic regime where the gas is much colder than the CMB. So you know, at 10, the gas is 2 kelvins colder than just about anything anywhere. Now, the spin temperature originally collisionally couples to the kinetic, but since the collision rate keeps going down as the density decreases and the temperature decreases, soon it starts coupling to the CMB. And it becomes invisible. It comes into similar equilibrium with the CMB, and then there's no 21 centimeter line to be seen. So if you look at the mean signal on the sky in a homogeneous universe, what you see is you see the 21 centimeter showing up as an absorbing signal with up to minus 40 millikelvin, and then it couples to CMB, and there's no net effect on the sky. So that's the purely homogeneous universe. And that's fairly robust, so that's led to, you know, people to propose observing this at redshift, you know, 50, 100 or something, which may even require going to the backside of the moon in order to, you know, get one ionospheric and other challenges. So this is a non-trivial place to observe and probably won't happen like real, real soon. Even though you never know, you know, people are starting a moon race again, you know, different countries are trying to get there again, so you never know, but this is ambitious, certainly. Now, there's another regime, which is once you have starlight forming, and presumably, you know, at some point, light did form, the universe did reionize. It sort of reionized around redshift 10 based on WMAP polarization scattering. So then you can ask, well, so clearly this thing will change once you have nonlinear structures form, and how much will it change? Well, that's really model dependent. It's not completely known. But the generic energetics tells you that it takes, you know, at least 13 EVs per atom to ionize, whereas there's another effect called Lyman alpha pumping, which causes the spin temperature. So if you have a small number of Lyman alpha photons, you know, they couple the hyperfine to the to the kinetic temperature of the gas because they scatter around. If they know about the relative velocities and they know about the spin temperature of the gas, so they'll couple that. And of course, the alpha photons can scatter many, many times before they redshift out of the window. So it only takes a small number of Lyman alpha photons to couple the spin temperature back to kinetic, so to pull this line back down again. The number of photons it takes is, you know, a few orders of magnitude smaller, something like 1,000 or something smaller than the number of photons it takes to ionize. So generally thought is, you know, well before you ionize, once the first objects form, even before you have enough in energy to ionize anything, you probably bring the gas back down into spin equilibrium with the kinetic, and then you will see the universe in absorption again. Now, when this happened, how it happened, is model dependent, so people who model this, you know, could happen different redshifts, could extend over different time periods, and this is clearly not something which we know yet, but on the other hand, it's fairly generic, you know, it's quite plausible that this, in fact, relatively likely that there was a period in which you had Lyman alpha refrigeration, cooling of the gas. And if you look at these plots, you know, this signal is much bigger than anything else anybody's going after. This is, you know, this absorption signal can be 100 millikelvin or more, compared to, and at a lower redshift, I mean, redshift 15, at least you probably could do from the ground, whereas redshift 100 is probably very, very challenging. And as many of you may know, you know, there currently are a series of reionization experiments, including our group in India, going after the signal at redshift 10, where it may already be in emission because other X-rays and other things may heat the gas. You know, obviously, there's a lot of complicated astrophysics that could enter by the time it reionizes at redshift 10. But so the relative challenge, at least in principle, of observing reionization, of which there are, you know, already half a dozen groups going after it, is about equally challenging as observing structures at redshift 15, where the signal is 10 times larger. But of course, the foregrounds are also 10 times worse. So it's not trivial by any means, but it is not like super futuristic. So this is something that, if this succeeds, you could imagine taking the next step and observing at redshift 15. Okay, this is not way, way, way out. It's something, it's, you know, that you could think of being the next step after you measure the redshift 10 reionization signal. It's incremental. It's not fundamentally off, which is why the estimate made here was saying that, you know, if there was such a regime and you can get to there in something SKA-like, you might be able to do this in the next decade or two, say. Those kinds of time scales, depending on how long you think it takes for people to get to the next stage. But certainly nothing as ambitious as the backside of the moon that's needed. Of course, you learn many other things from a 21-centimeter survey. You can learn about the gas evolution, redshift phase distortions, reionizations. Turns out if you're doing a survey, it's the same frequency band as redshift 21-centimeter. Also, it's good for measuring magnetic fields, rotation measures, pulsars, all kinds of things. So, you know, this is a regime that has been catching attention gained some momentum, both in terms of things like the square kilometer array and several dedicated transit surveys to map the universe again at low radio frequencies, because most of the attention development, like ALMA and recent telescopes, have all pushed the frontier of going to high frequency. Let me put again one more regime where 21 centimeter is starting to look interesting, which is the redshift range from 1 to 3, where there are many thoughts out there of that you could, by measuring baryon acoustic oscillations, you could measure, you know, the kinematic expansion history of the universe and do all kinds of good things that everybody here is familiar with. And the radio 21 centimeter, of course, has the attraction that the atmosphere doesn't do anything unusual in the redshift range, which is interesting for dark energy. In the optical, on the ground, this redshift range actually is fairly expensive to do. You know, most of your lines get absorbed by the atmosphere, so it's fairly hard to get a large number, to get, you know, billions of redshift in that range is currently not under discussion by anyone, since it's in a what we call an optical redshift desert. But in the radio, there's no fundamental reason that stops you. It's a clean, in principle, a clean range, and it's one of the goals that the square kilometer array has set to measure. This signal, by the way, how big is this signal at a redshift, say, 1.5 in the middle of the range? It's about a third of a millikelvin is the mean emission signal of the hydrogen. So only about 5% of the hydrogen is still neutral at that redshift. and the mean signal is, well, is as large or small compared to CMB scale. And CMB, this is a huge signal by CMB standards, so this is not not a subtle small effect. But there are challenges, and I'll explain a bit about why. Oh, about why that is. Note that the highest emission redshift ever observed is redshift 0.3. Okay, that's just with, you know, after doing this for 60 years now. In the last 60 years, the furthest they've gotten is redshift 0.3. So go to redshift 1.5, you might wonder, will it take another 60 years? Or, you know, are we talking about something really, really far in the future or something just around the corner? It's not quite obvious why this would be just around the corner if after 60 years we haven't gotten very far. The redshift 0.3, fairly modestly recently, like, I don't know, the last 10 years or something, when this 0.3 was... Not in the 1960s, but it didn't change that much. These telescopes are old, and the sensitivity hasn't changed that much over the last 60 years. It's been a long time. So one thing we've been proposing, so people, several of them in the room here, like Suding and others, that one quick way of going after this is to, you know, so far redshift surveys have all been based on the concept that you detect individual galaxies, you make individual detections, you make a redshift map, reconstruct your density field. And galaxies get faint as they get far away, so this gets clearly expensive and it's hard to see individual galaxies far away. On the other hand, you know, for people who make these, you know, BAO surveys, you know, often the goal, if your goal is not to understand the sizes and shapes of individual galaxies, but only to know statistically, you know, the power spectrum of them, which is what BAO is about, then you might not need to detect every individual galaxy, but you might just say, I'm just going to detect the large-scale structure power spectrum directly. So forget about individual galaxies. And then you can say that you can make your problem much, much simpler, much, much easier, because the characteristic pixel size that you'd ever care about is probably the nonlinear length scale, so a 20 megaparsec is probably the smallest pixel you'd really care about, smallest length scale you'd ever care about. And in 20 megaparsec cube pixels, there are many galaxies. Okay, so there are 100 galaxies typically in a single pixel, meaning you can get away with a 100 times smaller telescope if you only want to measure the collective structure that maps out the distribution of matter in the universe. To give you an idea of, you know, what large-scale structure is, it is the... credit is gone, of a halves, two mass distribution of galaxies. You know, remember that the acoustic structures in the CMB, the BAO in the CMB, is, you know, happens at degree scale or something, and this scale gets larger as things get closer. Okay, this is a large scale effect. You know, the resolution is just not an issue. Your eye is much better resolution than any of these structures would require you to have. So you're going after large scale structure of the galaxies as they're clustered on the sky, and you want to measure the power spectrum of this thing in three dimensions. The one challenge that you face if you want to do this directly without measuring individual galaxies is that you're competing in angular scale with synchrotron fluctuation emission from our galaxy. So this map has an amplitude which actually is a factor of 100 larger than the fluctuations in the 2110 meter signal. Okay, so this is a little bit of a challenge in trying to remove the galactic foreground. And since you're directly going after large angular scales and no longer trying to detect individual galaxies, you have to face this problem head on of whether you're going to remove this. Now, fortunately, synchrotron emission is a continuum process. You can calculate the spectrum. It's very smooth. It comes from an angle and energy averaging over the over relativistic electrons that end up with a very, very smooth spectrum. So at least in principle, if you estimate how smooth these things are, there's absolutely no problem in principle. To remove, so the information does not get contaminated at all. It's a very smooth pedestal. So if you make a three-dimensional cube and subtract the average along each line of sight, in principle, this thing should all go away. In principle, in practice, how hard is it? You know, can you really get the baseline spectral baseline along each line of sight down to 1% or better? That's, you know, the challenge. Yes.
Basically, the power spectrum in synchrotron from cosmograph. Do you expect like a cosmograph or a cascade
in angle? In angle, yeah. People, there have been a lot of estimates on that. In frequency, people have also calculated, but there's only calculated the structure. That's why the forecast. If you just calculate, you know, how much fluctuation is on a scale, that's very small.
So any there's no, so that's the only limiting step.
How is it done? That's my question.
On the side, all you need to know is the synchrotron integral of the distribution of electrons. Okay, so we can take the extreme case that all electrons have the exact same energy. Okay, all the Rydberg factor of 100. Let's say that's the worst I could possibly do, injecting all the same energy. But I still have, you know, take an angle average, and even then you find that it's not a problem removing them. So.
But they don't have the same energy. That's
that makes that much easier. Yeah, that's even better. You can warp a lot of, you can warp a bunch of featureless spectra and get even less featureless, even more featureless.
There is a feature at the temperature. You're saying there is no feature?
No, there's not. Sorry?
Isn't there a feature at the temperature of? Okay, so you're saying all of them are featureless.
Yeah, all featureless, all relativistic.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah, if it's truly monoenergetic in a uniform magnetic field, you get a whole forest of spikes. But as soon as you allow any non-trivial spread of the energies, then it's a Bessel function, something smooth,
something smooth. Well, that if you populate it electron only in one orbital direction along the magnetic field, you can get it. But if you angle, even the angle average gives you a smooth function. So
you're saying it's going to be smooth no matter, I mean, it's going to be negligible, basically.
So far, nobody's come up with a way of making it non-negligible. So there's no proposed mechanism that would make this thing short structure in principle. Now, that doesn't mean you can get rid of it in a real telescope. But I think the Kolmogorov challenges are thought to be technological, not intrinsic. That's what I think.
But has someone calculated that number? Is it small, 10 to the minus 12? Or
no, it's 10 to the minus 5 or 6 or something. It's, okay. I mean, it's small. It's not real, but it's...
It's 10 to the minus 5 of the background, or 10 to the minus 5 of your signal that you're going after? Or?
It's 10 to the minus 5 of the synchrotron, which is about 10 to the minus 3 of the signal.
Okay.
Per pixel. In close. It's small. I mean, it's intrinsic. Nobody thinks you'll get there because nobody thinks you'll calibrate your telescope to that accuracy, but... So that's I think most people think the problems will be elsewhere. So let's try this. Okay. By the way, there is a telescope. We can just go apply for time, and we applied for time on the Green Bank telescope.
So again, we have people sitting and Kevin and others, Kevin Banyu and Jeff Peterson, and you go apply and you say we want to measure the power spectrum of galaxies at redshift 1. And we say this is we don't actually care about galaxies. We just want to see if it can be done. And then they say this is a waste of telescope time, so you know there's no point in doing it. But fortunately for us, West Virginia, where this telescope is sitting, the reason it's sitting there is because there's a powerful senator named Robert Byrd, who managed to managed to get an earmark to get a telescope built in his state. And the good thing for us is that it's in a relatively wet and rainy state, and it's meant to operate at up to 100 gigahertz at very high frequencies, and it just cannot operate, it cannot observe, say, half the time. So half the time, the telescope just cannot do what people would like to use it for. And even if you get a poorly ranked proposal, they'll still give you the time because it's raining or it's windy or whatever. So you get to observe even if they don't think the science is interesting at low frequencies. So as long as you're not looking at high frequencies, and you're not looking at the galactic center. Those two things people actually want to see, and the rest people really don't care a lot about. So the telescopes it's easy to get time on, so you don't have to give a justification, basically, and you get time. At least modest amounts of time. Okay, so we got 20 hours this way. I mean, obviously, you have to fill in between things. Yeah, you know, it's not totally unsubscribed, but you can get 20 hours, certainly, on a fully ranked proposal. And here you make a map, okay? So here's what you're up against. This is what actually happens when you try to make a map. This is frequency from 700 to 900 megahertz, where 700 megahertz would be over here. Is that right? And 700 is... where did we go? What?
Low redshift. Sorry, low amount.
Okay, far away means low frequency. So this is 700 megahertz, and that's 900 megahertz on the left. Okay, and here, as you scan the sky, so this is the angular position on the sky. This is it's a fairly elongated rectangular strip matched to an optical survey called D2 that was detected with the Keck telescope. And so this is the same galaxy density field smoothed to the Green Bank telescope resolution, and there are only about four resolution elements across the strip that we have. You know, this is a low resolution object. the many gaps in every pixel, so this is a very statistical measurement. You're not going to be able to tell, and even if you had the sensitivity, you still wouldn't be able to tell which galaxy is which. The resolution isn't there. But we don't care anyway, it's not that we care about where the galaxies are, we want to know what the large structure is doing. And you can see that, I think this little gap is a cell phone band, that you cannot observe. And then on this side is the TV band. We can see there are regions that get hard to observe because of TV lips, and that's obviously horizon. So anyways, as you can see, the coherent structure with frequency is the foregrounds that include the galaxy, point sources, and other radio sources. That's what Neeraj was asking, you know, how smooth are they? Well, you know, they're smooth, and the structure in it is
mostly caused by, there's all the structure, but that structure is all instrumental, okay? There's none of the structures from the sky. Okay, everything you see is instrumental. And this has a typical structure of about 100 millikelvin. What's the typical fluctuation on this? 100 millikelvin kind of the structure.
And then you say, I'm going to go and subtract off the smooth part of it, and you end up with this map. Okay? And this map has a millikelvin type fluctuation. It goes on a factor of 100 just for doing that. So that's what level you want, okay? So factor of 100 is what you need, and that's what we have. I mean, there's still residuals, it's not like it may not be perfectly gone, but on the other hand, at least you can see that the first approximation, they really do go away. You really can't get rid of the foregrounds. And this telescope really wasn't even built to do that. This telescope was built to do other things. So it's done, and then you can compare this to the optical galaxy. You can run a cross correlation. Okay.
Was that a map or a spectrum?
It's a spectral this way and
radial distance this way. Right?
Yes, radial distance this way.
And then there's one dimension.
The one angle goes from 0 to 60, and then the next one actually is in front of this one. So you take two slices and put them back to back. So yeah, this is three-dimensional map, but that's elongated, so it actually is mostly along one direction. That's, I don't know why they did that, but that's what the optical template did. And now you can cross-correlate and ask, you know, is this real structure on the sky? And, the cross-correlation is positive, it's a good thing, not negative, and they seem to be consistent with the expected kind of, you know, amplitude and shape. So the black line is a fit with only a single degree of freedom, so the shape and everything is fixed by the D2 galaxy correlation function itself. There's a relative bias in omega h that you don't know, so that's allowed to be one key parameter for the amplitude. But you see that, you know, it looks like that that these two maps are statistically similar, and that the cross correlation does show kind of the signal you would expect with, you know, reasonable values for density. I mean, there are scalings in there that are degenerate with various things. For example, on hydrogen is degenerate with somewhat how biased
galaxies are and other things. But on the whole, though, you get to measure the thing you measure well is the temperature. A fluctuation correlation, which is 127 microkelvin. So that's the number you actually measure. To interpret this into a temperature requires a few other things that could have their own scalings, but we don't really care about those scalings. We care about the shape of the power spectrum, not the amplitude. So that's,
I don't know what the bias is, but this is degenerate, right? So this is what you measure, and if you assume a bias of 1, you get this omega 1. It's a relative bias, you know? Yes?
So what are the diamonds near 0?
It's a null test that if you randomize your galaxies, your voltage goes away. So it is in redshift. So if you radially shuffle the things, it shows that you actually get something to do with that test me. It's not just a fluke, hopefully, that getting the redshift right got you somewhere.
What is the function that you feed to the data?
It's a power law correlation function of D2, which goes as R over R naught to the minus, I forgot, 0.8 or something, with an R naught of 5. It's some number that you can measure these correlation functions in the optical data. And you take that correlation, which is the power law, and then you convolve it with a telescope beam, kind of expect to see, and then you convolve it with a pairwise velocity dispersion, and then you get a template of what you think you might be seeing. And there's no three parameter other than the amplitude that went into that. And all these numbers were taken from the D2 optical set correlation survey, if possible. Okay, so I think the state that we're in is that we have the first in,
first, I think, demonstration that this intensity mapping approach of going to high redshift with a modest-sized telescope, meaning a telescope that exists already, actually is a viable direction with a modest amount of telescope time, let's say 20 hours that went into this map. And I think we managed to persuade the allocation to give us not just spare time, but to actually give us real time. So next semester, they're going to give us 300 hours. Next trimester, they're going to give us 300 hours in the telescope, which is probably the biggest allocation they've ever given in a single trimester, to try to actually make a better power spectrum and to hopefully, cure was on that proposal, is hopefully to measure the redshift-based distortions and to actually do high redshift power spectra, which I don't think anybody's actually measured a redshift-based distortion, redshift 1. Have they? You have? In what? 0.8.
We've got going even back in
the deep because of the correlation function, but the redshift, but I think it's a fit for beta, for example.
We didn't fit for beta, but we've measured we have the measurements with the distortion.
Yeah, right. Okay, so that distortions. But the goal here would be to measure beta in 300 hours, which, again, in principle, one could measure beta in things like E2, but
yes.
It hasn't been done yet. Yeah.
We can talk about that.
This is meant to measure beta, which would break degeneracies between things like omega H1 and other things you have. Okay, CMB or PAOs, everybody knows about these guys, skips that. Then we say, well, how do we go forward? So the GPT has a single pixel detector, so it's slow going. If you want to map the whole sky to that depth, it would take 1,000 years or something to do that on a single pixel. It's not a very efficient way of going. I asked them, why don't you have more pixels on your telescope? They said, well, this one pixel is undersubscribed. Why would we have two? That makes sense to me. But on the other hand, and of course, that's why we're putting in proposals to ask for thousands of hours, and we're going to oversubscribe them and see what happens. Then of course, so far it looks promising that these foregone, they really do look like they are spectrally smooth, and that all these things, there are still issues. Of course, in a beam, that's a frequency, and there are other issues that we're working on and improving. But you can see that we're incrementally already in a regime where we only have to incrementally improve. We don't only have to improve as the area gets better, and we're doing about as well as we can at a given level of sensitivity. And now the thought is to build a dedicated survey experiment. This collecting area. This telescope was built to operate at 100 gigahertz, and the cost of a telescope goes as a fairly high power of the observing frequency, like cube or something of the observing frequency. So a 100-meter optical telescope would be really expensive, and 100-meter 90 gigahertz expensive. And you only need a 1 gigahertz telescope. So this telescope, the collecting area in principle, is very cheap. So it's a waste of a very good telescope, except it's raining there anyway, so it's kind of available. But if it wasn't raining all the time in West Virginia, this would be a waste of two waste of telescope. And of course, if you're going to survey the whole sky, there's no need to have the telescope move. So in principle, you could do it very cheap. And we have a proposal to build, to resurrect an old technology of cylinder telescopes, of which people had built several in the 60s, to build a modern version of it with a wide field of view. So this is Jeff Peterson's cylinder in Pittsburgh, based on which we've been pushing in Canada to build an all-sky survey telescope on this kind of parameters, 100 meters on a side, that would be based in Penticton. And the hope is that we can survey large volumes of the universe. So to put this in perspective, the idea is to survey tens of gigaparsec cubed at the redshift range going from about 0.8 to about 2.5 and map out the universe. So this is, you could map out a large amount of universe with a modest cost and modest amount of investment time. And the solid line here means that this is up to about 2, your cosmic variance limited, and above 2, it's a noise limited survey. So one could actually do better at higher, the sensitivity is not, cosmic variance limited at higher K. Good, so I think, I just want to summarize that we have, I think, a promising start on 21 centimeter cosmology. Okay, I think we're starting to see the first data. And we are also thinking forward, and hopefully in the not too distant future, we can really map out, the universe up to redshift 15, and in principle, learn a huge amount about the early universe.
Questions for Rayleigh?
Could you tell us some updates on the GMRT analysis?
The GMRT power spectrum, you mean? Probably do
yeah,
a
well,
how many detectors? Well, detectors. We are interpreting, we only communicate, we have a paper in the works, and we are only interpreting what we have by almost upper bounds. Okay, so yeah, there's always something there.
Sure.
It's probably a foreground residual. And but I think to make the claim that you've seen something requires you to have a lot of confidence in what you're doing. But to say that my real signal couldn't be much larger than what I see, that I think we can say with some confidence.
But you said something about foreground residual. So you actually now fighting against foreground
residual. Oh yeah, redshift 10. Redshift 10.
So when you say foreground, which kind is a diffuse galaxy signal problem?
It's a diffuse galaxy signal problem. Well, endpoint sources.
So sort of it wasn't as smooth as you might have thought, or?
No, it's just that GMRT is an interferometer, and there your beam is very frequency dependent. So to remove that, if you have a sparsely filled aperture, it's much, much harder to remove that. It turns out that the single dish turns out to be actually much easier since you don't have missing baseline, you know, there's no missing information. It turns out to be much, much easier than, that's why we have a signal here, we don't have one at bunch of 10.
Just very roughly, by which factor is the foreground cleaning easier if you do intensity mapping than if you do resolving realities?
Okay, so if you look at only, let's say, the square arc second that the galaxy occupies, okay, on that square arc second, a typical galaxy may have a temperature of a few kelvins, so brighter than the synchrotron. Okay, so that sense is infinitely easier, because even if we ignore the galaxy altogether, it'll stick up above the galactic foreground. And also the galaxy gets smoother at high L, so both of these effects go in that way that you require it requires no understanding of your systematics to do that. So short answer is the problem doesn't exist if you just map each galaxy individually.
And if you go to larger scales, then this is a better way.
But at larger scales, you don't need to collecting, because then you're required to detect every galaxy in a little pixel, and that's, you know, requires a huge telescope. So in our case, we're not doing this because it would be easier. It would be much, much easier for data analysis if we built a kilometer-sized aperture and just detect each galaxy separately and just cut hold on it and make a power spectrum out of just like in the optical. But that will take a long time before that happens. And meanwhile, we can do that now.
In the optical surveys, we have this issue of, you know, sky mass cuts, and we talk about doing things like BAO reconstruction. I think it's fair to say that we understand that we have a problem to solve, but nobody's actually solved it. So in this case, you have you're likely to have cuts that are in Fourier space instead, right? You have missing those and so on. You have this point source and you project it out and all of that. Do you have a feeling for which of those problems is easier?
Which of them is easier? That's
or harder.
Which question is easier?
The question is applying a nonlinear step like reconstruction is a algebraic not as easy procedure as say just measuring a power spectrum. And that issue we haven't even thought about, but if you have thoughts about it, we'd love to hear them.